Pints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony's still recuperating on the Cape, so Sean McNally's with me, who's been with me for a while right now, and he's bringing some great people on this with me, with him. And today...
Until today.
We have the FUs Part 2, Straw Dogs Part 2, but we've got Bob today. He came on and was able to talk with us. So we've got Ian, John, Steve, and Bob from the FUs Straw Dogs. And they're still at it. So, Sean McNally, would you please take over, because you've been talking with them. In fact, Ian sat right next to you in the office. And
this is true. Yeah, thank you, Dinky. Appreciate it. And I do have Ian next to me today, which is the first. We've never had somebody right in my quote-unquote studio for these calls. It makes it a little bit easier, so I appreciate him making the jaunt over here. And Bob, thank you for joining us. Well, we missed you in your first episode last week, but we had a lot of fun, and we'll certainly get back to giving you some more of the shine this time, so you can give us a little bit of your background. So before we go back and recap anything from last week, why don't we do that to start off with, Bob, if you don't mind. Give us your background as far as where you grew up, like how you got into the music scene, how you crossed paths with these guys, and then we'll go from there.
I grew up in Dorchester. Got into punk rock like 79, 80. Went to shows. I met John and Steve. John first through ads in the Phoenix looking for a band to join. First met John, then we met Steve. And then we started the FUs.
So before that, though, how did you, you said you're from the area, but as far as your exposure to punk music, you started as a punk in 79, 80. Like, how did you get to that point? That's like a bridge too far for a lot of people. How did it come across your path, so to speak?
I was a typical rock and roll teenager. And then in my, senior year in high school, I had just had enough of songs about dicks and chicks, and I rebelled against all my friends and everything I've been listening to, and I got rid of all my heavy metal, all my hard rock records, and I started listening to The Jam and The Clash and The Undertones, all the British stuff, and I just never looked back.
Those are some good bands you mentioned there. Was there somebody that introduced you to those bands, Bob, or did this come across your radar from seeing magazines or watching late night TV? I'm just curious, like how those bands kind of replaced all your rock and rollers.
It's like going to record stores and going to the new wave punk rock section and looking up bands, and more or less doing it on my own. I didn't know anybody.
Yeah. So did you, when you went to these record stores, did you come across other kids who were kind of like-minded or were like looking for something different to do?
No. I was strictly on my own.
Interesting. Interesting.
That's cool.
I know John later on, and we talked about before how important the Phoenix was. The Phoenix, of course, being a weekly periodical back then that doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately, but it was really kind of the Bible for a lot of the Boston and, you know, in Boston and beyond music scene to find out like what's happening between show advertisements, and also a huge, like essentially like a want ad, so to speak, in the back where we're looking for different bands or different band members or rehearsal spaces or recording studios, all that kind of stuff. That was kind of like the Bible back then. So that was your introduction, I guess, to finding the FUs. Was that your first band, or were you playing before you got involved with them?
No, that was my first band. I bought a drum set off another guy I was working with, and I learned how to play the drums in my basement, listening to Blondie and the Ramones and The Jam, and trying to figure out that stuff. You know,
so you're one of the fastest drummers I can think of. Like, what are those your influences from the beginning? The Ramones, clearly, Blondie. I mean, I'm just curious. Like, what are the influences? Or did you kind of just develop your own style the more you did it, or were there bands that kind of like said, oh shit, that's what I want to do?
It's kind of developed my own style because I couldn't play like anybody else. I didn't understand what I was doing. And then when we started playing, the music became faster and we wanted to play faster. Like all the English punk bands were too slow. So, you know, we just picked up the tempo and that's how I learned to play fast. Just in that's the FUs and just playing faster and faster and faster. And that's the only thing I know. I only know how to play fast. What I enjoy.
I like it.
You know?
That's great.
Yeah, well, it works. It definitely works. So, John, I think so. Bob was the first guy that you met, I think, to get the formation of the FU, so to speak, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I answered. He had an ad in the Phoenix that I answered.
So you put the ad in the Phoenix, Bob. Okay. Gotcha. Interesting. So that was your first band, and you were the one to put the ad out there. Yeah, that took some balls. Put your first ad in the paper saying that.
I was lonely.
That's excellent.
I put it in the wrong column. I was trying to put it in the adult entertainment.
Comedy for men. Yeah, I'm sure that's funny. That is good. That's good.
I guess I should say for anyone who wasn't there back then, there was this magazine called The Phoenix. It was also called Boston After Dark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was just this weekly thing about what's going on in town, and it had some, you know, classified ads in the back.
For sure. So what made the ad step out to you, John? Was it the stuff the bands he was mentioning as far as references that made them interesting to you?
Yeah, because they were he mentioned almost all the bands that I liked at that time.
That's pretty awesome.
And, you know, and none of the bands that I hated by that time.
Bob, and you said you were in Brockton, right?
Boston. I grew up in Dorchester.
Yeah. Dorchester. I'm sorry. Dorchester.
Yeah.
So what were your first shows? Did you go out and see shows? Were you seeing bands on TV? Like, I'm just curious, like the first time you saw those kind of bands that you wanted to be kind of emulated or, you know, head that path at least.
I had seen the Jam and the Clash and the Police and some other bands, you know, like regular shows. And the first hardcore shows were all the bands that were on Boston or LA. When the bands were playing, they'd be like seven people in the scene, you know.
Right. Like essentially the whole scene was at those shows. So,
exactly.
When you say you saw the Police in the Jam, you saw them in person, or you saw them on TV?
No, I saw them. I saw them like at the Orpheum or at the
awesome.
Paradise or wherever they were, or the Channel, of course.
Sure.
You know.
Excellent. We're going to talk about that for sure. As far as memory, last time we talked about, you know, the earliest show, which actually Steve had a big hand in setting up around Boston. And getting exposed to that kind of whole underground scene and really kind of seen explode in the Boston market for sure. As well as kind of a brand new thing back then, like you were saying, with the whole hardcore thing. And then, you know, this is Boston, LA, of course, which is today still, you know, a very high standard of or influential record that you just refer back to all the time and how important that was to introduce different bands from the Boston area to the world, really. So... you guys get together. We talked this before. Steve became one of your auditions for your guitar player. You did the three-piece demo. Did your first demo, and that was out there. And then VCN caught wind of some of the stuff you were doing. And then later on, you guys got in the studio and did a proper record. Maybe we can talk about that. I think we kind of skipped past that last time. We didn't really get much into the like Kill for Christ and Exclaim. Maybe talk about how what Exclaim Records was, first of all, and then how that record came together.
Okay. Exclaim was a label. It was like an affinity label, you know, because every band did their own advertising, their own artwork, their own recording. You know, it wasn't like a label where they give you an advance and then you record and then you try to make it back. We also had to sell our own records too, you know, which occasionally got confusing, you know, if we get a check for a Jerry's Kids record and vice versa, you know. But the good thing about it, you know, that Al had this idea because, you know, people were buying Discord records just because they said Discord on them, right?
So,
So he came up with his own version of Discord, and you know he let people use it as long as they were independent, and that's how we got on there.
And of course, Freddie, we're listening. Al is Al Baril of SSD Control, or Society System D Control back then. SSD was, and still, very, very, very influential band in the whole hardcore scene in Boston. And Al was kind of like the, you know, the linchpin, so to speak. He was really kind of the focal point, or the godfather, I guess, of the Boston scene. And this was his label, like John just said, Exclaim, which is a letter X, C-L-A-I-M after Exclaim. And those first few records that came out, including the FUs, if, you know, those are very highly desirable records and very collectible and very expensive. You get a hand, get your hands on one of them for sure. So it's like you said, it was kind of an informal thing back then. There was no like contracts. It was like, yeah, you want to use my name, cool. Because Exclaim had the SSD record at that point, and then you guys put out Kill for Christ. You use the Exclaim tag on it, which I'm sure helped some kids understand. Like, oh, cool, they're part of the SSD thing, so to speak. And then I just made a note. You had 19 songs in 26 minutes. That was perfect.
Yeah, well, I love it. I love it. Yes.
And I know that Steve wrote a bunch of songs up front. And then how quickly did the whole studio thing come together for you guys? Was just like, okay, we're ready. We got a bunch of songs. Let's go in and do it real quick. Was it a fast? Was, I mean, this is like 1982, so it was early. It was early on. Did it just kind of get it really quickly, guys, try to make it writing songs together and just want to get them on record really quickly?
I think we formed, you know, as a three piece, you know, in the fall of 81. So, it might seem quick if you think we started in 1982, but it wasn't quick on our end.
I think you said you had one song of your own, and Steve had a bunch of songs when he came and joined the band. Yeah. But you're still talking like not even a year, maybe, between the three of you guys kind of forming that nucleus and then getting in the studio and putting a record out, right? That's pretty quick.
That's quick.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I guess it was. This is a long time ago, but yeah.
We got the stuff in between. We put in the stuff. We recorded the stuff for Boston Out LA, and that came out. And then we had, by the time that came out, we had a bunch more of our own songs. We said, well, you know, we were talking about doing the Exclaim thing. We said, we want to put out an EP of our own, and we did that. So we went to this one studio, and we were all ready to do everything, but the guy we were working with was not probably one of the best people to work with. We'd been spoiled by working with Lou Giordano and sure. Larry DeForest at Radio Beat, and they were very professional and got everything done. But recording Kill for Christ was a little bit harder. We had our stuff done, I think.
Yeah,
but the guy. Yeah, any memories of how you blew up? Any other memories of the recording process of getting those songs down on vinyl?
Like you said, actual specific memories. Yeah, there were some moments when the recording wasn't going well, not on our end. And I don't know. I don't want to name names or anything. I don't want to name names or anything. But just the whole thing back then. The scene. Just back up a minute. The scene back then. There were no rules. There were no guidelines. Things were just happening. Yep. And that's what was fun about it. You know. When you look back on it, yes, everything did happen fast. It was a short amount of time, but we were a lot of friends. You know, on the whole, there weren't many of us, but we were all friends, and things just moved along really quick. We popped up with the scene. Everyone was like-minded, the music they wanted to play, and there was a good amount of shows, and there was not a lot of friction between people because, like I said, it was a very small group. It was a very intimate setting. I think Boston, not L.A., made it seem like we had a giant music scene, which we really didn't. But we had a good point.
Yeah. Good point. No, it's a great point for the community, Bob, because like you say, it was really a very small community of people and bands. And, you know, a lot of the times you're playing on the same bills together, whether, you know, at Media Workshop or Gallery East, and, you know, eventually the Channel and whatnot, or the hall shows that Steve was setting up in Cambridge. Yeah, it really was kind of a very insular scene of people that were all supporting each other, not really knowing what you're doing, right? It was kind of like you're creating your own thing. So the whole idea of like, well, how does this whole record process work? There really was nothing on, no blueprint, so to speak, right? You kind of did your own thing for the most part.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
and it worked out being a pretty damn good thing, right? So then, I mean, that was 82, and then not even a year later, My America comes out, the next record, and that's also with Exclaim. That was 11 songs in compact, 11 songs, 15 minutes for that one.
That's my favorite.
That's pretty powerful. How about memories of that one? Was it, you guys said you were doing a couple different producers in town you worked with. Was that any memories from that one as far as studio, good or bad?
I remember going to get cream horns while we were recording. That's all I remember. I ate a lot of cream horns during that session.
A big recording budget, I'm sure. Yeah.
That was working with Lou Giordano again, and I put on that record once a couple of years back for the first time in several years, and I was like, boom! I was just kind of blown away the sound he got out of it. It's just a powerful production, I think.
And the first time we recorded with him, it was just 8 tracks. So he was like punching in is what he used to call it. If you wanted to have like an extra guitar track in a certain part, you know, he'd like go over maybe an ambient mic or something like that just to squeeze in another part, because he was only working with 8 tracks at first.
I think
have it sound so full with just 8 tracks was pretty amazing, I think.
Yeah.
But that's why he's a big deal now, you know. He works with Bob Mould, and he works at the famous Strad Nozzle Studios in Connecticut now.
Yeah, he definitely made a name for himself, for sure. What were you going to say, Bob?
I think at the time, GBH had come up with a series of singles, and they had a really huge full sound, and that was the sound I wanted for the record, and that's what we ended up with, a really big, powerful, blow you out of your chair sound. I thought that was awesome.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool.
Very cool.
Then next, a year later, you guys were working pretty rapid fashion. 84, Do We Really Want to Hurt You came out, and that was, I think it was 13 songs in 32 minutes. So you guys actually gave me a little bit longer songs that time.
Did we talk about My America already?
Yeah. Well, we just kind of mentioned it briefly. We could talk about more detail. Go for it.
No, I lost the plot. I thought we were jumping ahead to the third record before talking about the second one. But
yeah, we can talk about My America somewhere. No, we're just kind of following the timeline. How compact, you know, looking back, it's like it might get. I know everything went by very fast, and it did. But you guys had an awful lot accomplished in a very short amount of time between, as Steve mentioned, the Boston LA, but you also, you know, Trumpet Christ was 82, My America 83, Do Really Want to Hurt You 84. So you guys were working hard. I mean, you were gigging, you were playing, you also getting a lot of records out there that were pressed at that point. So now we can get more on that. Do you want to dig in some more?
We got on a couple of compilations too, the Master Tape and Flipside.
Good. Yeah, don't talk about that, because when the third record was not on Exclaim, right? So Do We Really Want to Hurt You? And that was on, is it Gastanka and Enigma?
Yeah, Gastanka, right.
Okay, and how did that come about? As far as like, were you guys approached for that, or was it something where you guys actively seeking a different label at that point? How did that come up? How did that come together?
I think he approached Bob, didn't he? Didn't he write to you, Bob? I don't know exactly. Bill Bartel.
Yeah, I mean, we were friends with him, and he had a record label, and he offered to do a record with us, so I guess that's what we did. I don't remember the details. That's too far away.
Well, we didn't know enough of the details, as it turns out. But you know, we're still lucky that we got a record out, you know.
Yeah, I mean, those are still songs you guys play to this day. I mean, you know, Warlords, Young Fast Iranian. I mean, two of your most popular songs, at least I speak to. I mean, two of my favorite songs. I mean, those are still songs in your play set today, which is, 40 plus years later, which is pretty incredible.
Yep.
Yeah, me and Mackay or Sub Bop or whoever is listening, you know, if you want to put that album out again, that'd be great.
Well,
not too many people have it. That's why it's such an expensive aftermarket record.
Yeah. So let's talk about, at this point, we got the transition from FUs to Stray Dogs, right? So we're talking like mid-80s at this point, 84, 85, 86. Steve Martin comes on. Bones Jones is drums for a bit in the studio before he unfortunately, of course, passes away right when the record's coming out. How did the transition happen as far as, how do you recall it happening from, okay, the music was changing a bit at the time, obviously, and all these hardcore bands were kind of, swaying more towards the metal side of things, which seemed to be, more popular or more, it was everywhere, right? Everybody from even the Black Sabbaths of the world were starting to make more accessible records, so to speak, compared to the really dirgy, dark, heavy stuff from earlier. Not to mention all the, the Boston hardcore scene, other parts, New York, all these bands started kind of, what do you want to call it, crossover, what do you want to call it, something different. How did the transition in your eyes kind of happen from FUs to Straw Dogs?
Yeah, it's funny because we weren't part of that crossover, because the crossover was all like, it was what they call V-beat now, it was that double kick constant, and vocals that are okay, I guess. but for us, it was, I think it was more like, going back and, well, Bob had joined the band, had left the band before we became Straw Dogs. But
because I didn't like the way the music was headed.
Right.
That's why I dropped out of the scene, because it's like you said, everything was changing. And it was, to me, in my opinion, it was going back to the music I ran away from in high school. So I was like, I don't want to go back to those days. So I said, I'm done. So that's when I left the FUs.
Well, for me, it was similar, but in reverse. I was getting too saturated in the Boston hardcore music and hardcore music in general. And there were all these new bands coming out sounding exactly the same and sounded like each other, and I didn't like the way that was going, so I started listening to some records that I stopped listening to, and I thought, oh, this isn't so bad. it was like getting away from the numbers, as the jam would say, and getting into something that was, now it was taboo, right? I mean, before it was just passe. Now it's like, no, oh, you like that? Right. I can't talk to you anymore, So to me it was an act of rebellion, and it was fun. So
kind of interesting from the different standpoints or viewpoints. I'm actually gonna, I'm sitting here with Ian, who later joined the band, of course. But Ian probably has a pretty good perspective on this. He was already a fan of FUs, as we know, and had seen you guys several times prior in the Boston scene. But I'll let Ian take over a couple minutes here and just kind of give us his feel for what the Straw Dogs became, or what that meant to him, because I know he thought they were an extremely powerful band for sure. So let me turn over to Ian for a couple minutes here and talk about that, what he thought about it.
Yeah, I was a big fan of the Straw Dogs, but it was kind of funny. My first thought about the Straw Dogs was after the Mr. Beautiful comp that the band was going to change its name to the Straw Dogs. And I remember sitting in Kenmore Square with a bunch of friends on the steps. We were talking about it, and some of us said, oh, I think they're naming the song after the Stiff Little Fingers song. And other people were saying, I was saying, no, I think that John's a Peckinpah fan, and I think he's naming it after the movie. And we went back and forth, and sure enough, walking through Kenmore Square comes John Fox. And everybody was like, well, there's your chance, Ian, go talk to him. So I went up to John, and I said, hey, John, I hear the band's changing its name to the Straw Dogs. Could you tell me what the Straw Dogs means? And he goes, it's a dog that burns. And I was like, what did John say? And I said, he says it's a dog that burns. That didn't exactly answer any of the questions that we had. The thing I want to say about the Straw Dogs is, and this is for all my friends, is we really followed that band heavily. We continued to follow that band. And the songwriting didn't change. And that's, I think, the most important thing, if I think of the FUs and the Straw Dogs, is the songwriting. This was a band that had, multiple parts of the songs. Even if you look at the first record, Kill for Christ, like a song like like daisy chain. There's like four parts, you know? And so these guys always poured it all into their song. So when the Straw Dogs record, the Green record, came out, all of a sudden we have really exciting songs. I don't know anybody that didn't love Trigger Finger. Oh, yeah. And, you know, when In Deep came out as an FU song, I think everybody was aboard with that. And we thought, okay, these guys are changing the name. And we understood why they were changing the name, because they were now beginning to play shows with, like, Megadeth and stuff. And FU's was not going on the marquee of a big rock club. But, and absolutely didn't lose any of its fans by changing the name. They did pick up a couple of friends of mine as roadies. Might have been a little less vocal in my appreciation because they had friends like Kevin Hall roading, and then they got another buddy of mine after Bonesy playing drums, EK, which was, you know, and I super wanted to be friends with these guys, and it just wasn't happening. I kept putting my foot in my mouth over and over again with them. So
that's good stuff. Awesome.
Well, you were in with a fast crowd, so we didn't know didn't think we should get to know you too quickly, you know.
So, I'm curious now. The so the EP, the EP first of all, that came out on Restless, correct? How did that transition happen? How did you guys get hooked up with that?
That's actually a really good story. We got nominated somehow to be in the WBCN Rock and Roll Rumble, the 85 one, paving the way for other bands that sounded like us that actually won, just by virtue of the fact that we were semifinalists. But we played and we had technical issues. I don't know if it was sabotage, but half of the stage, the power went out. So, you know, Steve Martin was flailing away and nothing was coming out of his amp. And we just looked at each other and we just kept going. We were like, what are we going to do? We just kept going. And then the stagehands worked on it while we were playing. So I think like towards the end of the set, you could hear everybody. And one of the things the judges said was, you know, these guys are really professional. They really showed grace under fire. You know, they didn't whine. They didn't walk off stage or anything. They just kept going. So, that helped us be liked by the judges. One of them was Peter Wolf, who told Bones afterwards that it's like, oh, you guys are really good. And Bones was all jazzed. You know, he's a 17-year-old kid getting a compliment from a Boston rock star. another one of the judges happened to be working at Restless. Okay. And she was here from California. And she was like, she talked to Julie, Julie Chrysler, who was our manager at the time, and said, you should talk to us. and that's how that came about. And so we did great, like, in our, what do you call it when you're just trying to break in the contest? I guess it's like our first night. Let's keep it simple. Our first night we did well. And then the second night, the semifinal night, Oedipus and Albert O were rooting for us. But we weren't New Wave, and New Wave was destined to win that particular year. So, you know, Down Avenue became the ultimate winner.
Right. This was as the FUs. You guys participated in the 85 Rumble as the FUs. I was going to say, do you remember who the winning bands were? You're right, though. Down Avenue was the winner. You came in second place?
No, not second place. We got to be semifinalists, but not in the final round.
Right. No, I was saying Down Avenue was the winner, but the second place runner-up was actually Adventure Set. The other bands in the semis with you guys were Bamboo Gang, Chain Link Fence, and Scruffy the Cat, which, of course, nothing at all you. FUs, for sure. So.
Right.
So out of that, basically, became the name change in the Restless deal. So that is pretty cool. So at least that let the record deal, which a lot of bands didn't get back, you know?
Right. Yeah, that was quite lucky.
But how did that work out with them? And I know not long after you did your first full length, that, right? We Were Not Amused. Was that also with Restless? I think it was. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
But shortly after that, Restless was kind of churning, and you know, didn't know where to go. I mean, they had great distribution through Enigma. You know, they were like getting the same distribution that Stryper got. That Christian rock band.
Sure.
But they just lost their way. They didn't know. They were trying to be an arty label, but you know, they had us on, they had the outlets on, you know, so it just seemed like it was going in too many directions at once, I think, and that's why they called it quits.
Gotcha. And then any other you guys, Steve, Bob, any other memories from the recording, either the EP or actually what was the EP at that point, Bob, right? So Steve was, though, as far as We Are Not Amused, any recording stories you can think of or memories?
Well, I just wanted to point out that, you know, we went and recorded the EP and then went ahead and recorded the album. And then, unfortunately, Bones died.
Right.
And, you know, before he died the day or the night after, I guess the night or the night after that, the record came, the EP came out.
The early morning of the day, because it came out on May 1st.
Right.
And he
right.
died early in the morning of May 1st. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's a date I'm not likely to forget.
Yeah.
Right. Of course.
But that, you know, we had those two records out, and then, you know, we kind of had some lineup problems trying to keep, we did some touring, but the lineup wasn't all that secure as it had been. And
we talk about bad luck, never mind, you know, the fact we lost the guy passed away, but it's like you lose your drummer after a record, you know, two records around, you go ready to start taking over the world, right? Down the road, touring, and then it's like, oh shit, 10 steps backwards, right?
Yeah, because we were psyched. We were like, oh yeah, this is going great, man, you're gonna tour this summer and blah 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 blah, you know, and then kaboom,
right?
Yeah. So, and we were getting lots of press, like from metal magazines too. We had like this five-page spread in Rip, which had all these arty color pictures in it, and we got written up in Kerrang magazine. We got 5Ks, which is their highest record rating for We Are Not Amused. And
that's gigantic. Wow, having them in your corner with 5 stars is a huge sell. Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, and we got it written up in Hit Parader too. There's this guy who does his favorite indie record of the month, and he liked We Are Not Amused also. He said these guys don't play every note they play seriously, but you know, they have the kind of sense of humor that is really lacking in music these days.
Very true. Yeah, very true statement. So those two records are out, and then, like you say, you're struggling through the lineup thing and, you know, how to carry on, I guess. So, and then there's a third record, Your Own Worst Nightmare, that came out later on, different labels. I mean, did the rest of the thing just kind of come to an end? They moved on, or you guys just decided that we're off to something different now?
No, they folded.
Okay. Gotcha. I think it was Lone Wolf Records in Toronto put out that record, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you had a German distributor as well, Lost and Found, is very well known overseas. They put out the record in Germany.
No comment.
Yeah, it's okay. Well, there's quite different. There's a problem with some Boston hardcore bands getting what's the word for it? Bootlegged. That's a good word, Ian.
Right.
Bootlegged or having records printed up without knowledge of the actual band members and people who actually get paid on that. So yeah, we'll just jump over that right now.
Right.
So then, later on, stepping out a little bit further down, I know Clashy Records did re-release the FU. I don't know, was it the whole catalog or any certain stuff? I forget now. They did both records together, all three records together?
No, just My America.
My America only. Okay. Okay. And how did that come about? Do you recall?
Yeah, me. and Adam Donius, who was Bob Sensi's drummer in a couple of bands, and he was in Eye for an Eye for a while. I met him through Wayne because they were neighbors in Austin and you know, saying I'd like to start a label, and I said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. You know, we're just sitting around talking in a bar. I didn't think he was actually going to do it, but then we did it. So, and then he moved back to New York. So that's how that happened.
Okay. How about, so the band kind of came to an end, and then Johnny, I know you started another band, with Taylor, but that was like, we're talking now like early 2000s, right? It was like 2005 or six, I think it was.
No, late 2000s.
Okay.
Like, I think it might have been like 2008 or something when we started, and I don't know when in 2008, but.
Okay, and then the rebirth, so to speak, of that fuse kind of coincided with, there was a movie coming out from Drew Stone, who was a New York movie producer, video producer, whatnot, and New York hardcore archivist for the most part. He was working on a movie. You want to be talking about that a little bit? And you guys want to jump on that?
Yeah, well, Drew is, he's actually comes from a film family. His father was the director of that movie, Papillon. So you know, he wanted to do his own thing, but he was mostly doing BMX movies.
Oh yeah.
And you know, because there's a niche for that, and and then he decided, oh, you know, we should talk about the history of the Boston scene. Because a lot of people in Boston and a lot of people in New York are interested, and he's from New York,
right?
But he was going to Emerson at the time when he had a band, a Boston hardcore band called the COs.
Correct. Yep.
So, anyway,
Mighty COs and Antidote later on. So yeah, so Drew Stone was in school in Boston. You know, fell in pretty hard with the whole Boston original guy. You know, the SSDFU's crew, the you know Gangrene, all the early bands. Went back to New York and like I said, become very successful with making videos for bands and whatnot. And he's also had his own documentaries, several documentaries. I would highly recommend you check them all out. They're really cool, very in-depth. But the one in Boston, it was called XXX All Ages, XXX, against the whole straight edge X thing, the Boston Hardcore Film. So there was a process of this film that he was working on. He was getting a lot of archival footage and whatnot. He was interviewing all the Boston scene people. And then I guess the idea of an actual show came up, and then you guys essentially partook in that show, yes?
Yeah, the three X's, I think it kind of confused people, especially when you're using the word hardcore describing your music. But that's actually something Drew came up with when he was here, when he had the COs, because triple X to him meant triple speed straight edge hardcore.
Oh.
So, so I guess it stuck with him, and he used it in the movie title too. Plus, there's also another movie called All Ages. I think he told me. I don't know if it's a big movie or not, but he couldn't use it.
Okay. I mean, that's part of the issue then. Okay. It's also American hardcore. So yeah, I got you. I think it was Katie, the cream leader, that reached out to you as far as getting.
Yeah.
Tell me about that story, if you don't mind.
Yeah, she found me in the phone book. You know, we still had them back then, and this was 2010, right? And she said, you know, I'm talking to Drew Stone and Dwayne Lucia, and you know, they want to make a movie about Boston hardcore, and you know, we'd like you guys to play at the kickoff for the movie, right? And I said, oh, well, that's cool, you know. And then she said, and you know, we could do some interviews with you guys too, and like that. So that's how that part came about. And
getting back together, John, in that point, or was it just the motivation for it to happen?
You know, Katie insisted. I said, but I'm just in a band. I'm the only original member of the band. I'm playing with some guys that really like the FUs, and we're doing FUs covers until we get our own sound. And she said, well, call Bob for Apple. Okay. I didn't think he would respond, but I called him, and he did. You know, At first he thought I was kidding, but then, you know.
Yes, I did. At first, John, I said, nobody listens to this kind of music anymore. And then John sent me a video of Payload playing in New York, and there were skinhead kids jumping through the air, and I was like, seriously? I was like, okay, I'll do this. This looks good, you know.
Wow. Yeah. That's pretty amazing. How did that make you feel, though? I mean, as far as, you know, like you said, Bob, you thought you already moved on from the whole deal, but here it is coming back full force into a really, really big Boston show. How did it kind of, were you caught off guard?
Absolutely, but I thought it was so much fun, you know, and I still do to this day. I think playing shows is fantastic, you know. I think that's what it's all about.
Yeah, I couldn't believe how many people were not only into the music, but they, you know, they're all wearing leather jackets and badges. And I'm like, where were these guys? Where were these kids when we were playing? I guess their parents were bringing them to shows. I don't know.
It's probably right.
That's pretty great. And the actual show that came out of that was a show in August of 2010. So almost exactly 16 years ago, actually, which is pretty crazy. At Ted Lido in Revere, Mass, which is right across from the old Wonderland dog track, which is no longer there anymore.
Right.
I'm not even sure if Clovito is called Clovito anymore or something different. It's right at the end of the blue line. Close Revere Beach, actually. But I think the show kind of caught everybody off guard how many people came out for it. It's because it was a lineup of, you know, a lot of the old throwback Boston bands, right? It was FUs, of course, also DYS, Jerry's Kids, Gangrene, and then, you know, Drew's other band, Antidote, opened the show. A couple of the local bands on
and
the
bill. DYS, and that band from the Cape. Can't think of their name right now.
But can I jump in here?
Yeah, I'm going to Ian jump on this for a minute.
It's actually the second FU show that they did on reuniting. The first FU show is a few weeks before, actually almost a month before, and I got a Facebook memory tag just a few weeks ago. They played with Channel 3 at the Middle East before the Lido show, and I brought my 2-year-old son to his first show. I've got a photograph in my arms at that show with a Middle East headset to protect his ears.
I love it. I think it's great.
Well, Ian's a diehard fan for sure. So that show, I guess, was kind of the impetus to, you know, I guess, reform the band. So this, I tell me if I'm wrong, John, because you guys have been playing pretty much, I think, pretty steady since then, no?
Yeah. More than ever. Because when I think of the old days, I'm looking at these flyers and like 30% of them never happened. But there are people who swore they were there and we were awesome. So I'm not going to argue with them.
That's a good point.
But clubs were really afraid. They heard about moshing, they heard about slam dancing, they heard about kids coming in with fake IDs, and they would cancel shows the night before they were supposed to happen. Steve made a flyer once that at the bottom it said, all dates subject to change.
That's good. You guys all played in that show, yes or no?
What's that?
Did Steve, Bob, you all played in that show at Club Lido?
Yes.
Yeah.
Give me some memories from that show, because that was nuts.
Wayne also played.
Oh, Wayne Meister. Okay, we should say, actually, you know what? We should mention Wayne Meister, right? Because Wayne passed away, unfortunately, as well earlier this year. Or was it last year late? And we had a little get together early in the year. It was really, really nicely done. And, a lot of folks came out to celebrate his memory. He was playing bass at the time. Another one gone too soon. But you guys did play in that show, and just I guess memories from that show, if you don't mind.
Yeah, Wayne and Richie Rich split bass duties because Wayne was living up in Maine at the time, and he didn't have time to rehearse all the songs. So Richie was playing with me in Payload. He did half the set and Wayne did the other half, and you know, they both sounded good. We also had, Mick Stunt, Mick Carter George. He's in a band out of, Pacific Northwest called the Stunts, but he was living in Marblehead at the time. And he was giving us a place to rehearse in his basement. So he played guitar and, you know, and so he played rhythm, and so Steve could get up there too. And it sounded good. I think it was the first time a lot of people had heard us with two guitars, and I was happy about that because I think we sound great with two guitars.
Sure, of course. How about you, Steve? Any memories, Steve, from the show?
Well, my favorite thing was, like, Wayne played the first eight songs or so, or first half of the set, and then he takes off his bass and he goes, "You guys suck. I quit." And
I did not know that. That's funny.
It's perfect Wayne, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I love that.
He was a good guy.
The kind of things that come out during these calls. This is great. That's a great story.
Yeah.
How about you, Bob? Any memories of behind the drum kit for this one?
The whole show was just a blast because it was a reunion of all these people I hadn't seen in years, you know?
Right.
It was one of the good days.
I mean, you think about it, it was almost 30 years since, you know, you guys played that first show with the Misfits, 82, yeah. Right? 2010. I mean, it's, like you said, a lot of people kind of disappeared. Well, the scene, you know, the scene goes through different waves, right? So it stopped for a while. There were no shows for a while, and it kind of came back, and different, you know, different bands come up. And then, but these old throwback bands we're talking about from that gallery reunion show, I mean, man, you talk about what a lineup to try and put together and pull it off. And I give Drew a lot of credit for that because that's a hell of a show. And I mean, people still talk about it this day, about how great it was seeing people they hadn't seen in, you know, literally decades, like you guys just talking about, and seeing a bunch of your friends back together like the old days, you know, hanging out and going stage diving and check out your friends' bands and just catching up for people after years and years not seeing each other, right?
Yeah, it was like a hardcore high reunion. That's what it was.
I like that.
Well said.
You know, 10 minutes, Sean. I think this is great.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah, we're going. So let's take it from there. So that's kind of the FUs, I think, kind of relaunched, so to speak. And you guys have been pretty active since. I know Ian jumped in with the band a couple years later. I mean, Ian, how did you get back with the band at that point? How did you join, become a full-time FU?
Yeah, my wife left me. We got a house in Salem. My wife left me, and I found myself single a lot of the, you know, half the week. I'd take my kids and drop them off at her house for a few nights and find myself with nothing to do. And so I was angry, you know, and I was pretty depressed, and I needed something to fill that time up when I didn't have my kid for a couple nights. So a buddy of mine said that a friend of his needed a guitar player. And so I said, yeah, I can, you know, practice with these guys for a little while. This was Al Quint, and he had a band, Shattered Silence, that I jumped in on, and we did a couple of shows. We did a big show at Hardcore Stadium, and it went super well. And then we ended up playing for about a year or two and opened up for a lot of gigs over at Hardcore Stadium and a lot of the DIY shows. And I was playing guitar pretty regularly at that point, and I got John Sox and I started talking. We went to, I think, see the Dam together or whatever, and we hung out a bit. He said that the FUs were looking for a new guitar player and that I want to come audition. And I said, okay. So, well, what should I do? And he said, learn as many songs as you can and show up to practice. And so I spent about a week, maybe 2 weeks, every night with my record player and the old records app. And I tried to get myself to learn about 20 songs or so. I picked 30, but I think I really only learned about 20, 21 songs. And I showed up to practice, and my buddy Ed from Psycho was playing bass at the time. And we launched into 20 songs. At the end of it, nobody said anything. Nobody said, hey, that's good, or... He just kept saying, do you know any more songs? I said, okay. And I'd tell him another song, and we'd play it. And that went for a while, and nobody said anything. And then they said, okay, that's good. We'll get in touch with you. And then Ed said, we have another person showing up now, so you got to leave. And I said, oh, okay. And he goes, yeah, we're auditioning a few people, and we'll let you know. And as I was going down the stairs, I saw Joe Coons of the Freeze coming up the stairs. And I said, he's auditioning, forget it. I've just wasted a week practicing all these songs. And then John called me up a few days later and said, we auditioned, as you know, Joe Coons, and he sounded great, but you sounded good too. And I think that we like Joe's leads, but we really like your rhythm. And would you be interested in doing a two-man kind of a thing? And I said, yeah, of course. I'd be happy to be the rhythm player. And so that's how that relationship started. And that started in summer of 2015. And we've been playing ever since. We've gone on several European tours. We've gone to Japan. We've made a record.
So, no, that's great. That's fantastic.
Happy and honored to be playing with these friends of mine that I have personally watched play for, you know, 42 years, 43 years now.
That's we had three guitarists in rotation because he was living in Texas at the time. Mm-hmm. And he would fly up for shows when he could. Then, you know, he'd say, okay, one of you guys has to take a back seat because Steve's coming up. and then Steve moved to Salem, which is so much better because, you know, we can rehearsal them anytime.
That's great stuff. It's always great to join your favorite friends or your band, your favorite friend band or your band that you idolized or saw for years as a fan. Now you're in the band. That'd be pretty cool. Much more cooler than that. So to get to a wrap up here, I know we're getting to the end of the hour. And again, thank you guys for making the time. I knew we'd have a lot to talk about, and we got coming up on the end of our second hour here. But just to the outside world, the FUs are still very much a band and still very much playing. They just did a 4-day weekend run with Gang Green to celebrate 40 years of Another Wasted Night from 85, which is crazy, 40 years back again. But, you know, I saw the show in Portland. It was awesome. They did Boston, Portland. They did Albany and Connecticut. That just happened, you know, again, this is mid-August. We're talking about a month ago. Not even a month ago. They're doing it. So check out the find the FUs online and see when they're playing again and come up to a city near you. Anything you guys want to say last minute to anything else you're working on, music or otherwise, you want to chat on before you wrap up?
I'll let the major songwriter answer this.
Well, we're getting an album's worth of new stuff together, and we've got most of that. So
awesome.
We hope to be getting a new album out soon.
Yeah, the way we used to put out records so fast a long time ago, we are the exact opposite now. Put it that way.
Yep,
that's hilarious. So, do you have a website?
The difference is about just having fun with your friends, right? That's great. Yeah. That's a good.
We're crafting them carefully. That's the
Do you guys have a
title album, Crafting Carefully, our next record or something, right?
Yeah. That's it. I mean, we realize now that people are actually going to listen to it. So, you know, it's not just our friends, you know, people that might have no opinion of us yet.
Do you guys have a website or a way that people can see where you're going and gigging and stuff?
Yeah. I suppose I should have memorized it before I did this interview, but I can text it to, we have a couple. I can text them to Sean and maybe he could just throw them on at the end.
Okay.
Well. Yeah, we can, another on Facebook, it's DFU's band, right? It's spelled out, I think. We should know this, right? I'm not quite as prepared as I should have been for this. I think it's called DFU's band, spelled out is how you're going to find them on Facebook.
Okay. I should know this too, but since it's connected, I should know this too. But since it's connected to my personal Facebook account, I just click on the black triangle and I'm over there.
Technology is not our friend.
Here, hold on.
Yeah, we're gonna have Ian look it up real quick so we get the right information out there
for me. It is FU's Music 2. .bandcamp.com.
Oh, wow.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
That's not the Facebook one, though. He was talking about the Facebook one.
All the records and all the songs, and Steve updates the shows on that, or somebody does.
So you can get either track it down through Bandcamp or through Facebook. Just type in FU's or FU's band, and it'll you'll come across it for sure.
FU's Music 2, no apostrophe at all.
Okay, there you go.
That's fantastic.
I'll post it on, when we post the episode online in a couple weeks, I'll tag the address on this. You guys can figure it out online. But thank you guys very much. I know we're getting up against the time here. I'll let Dinky wrap things up. I thank you guys for making the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much appreciate it. You guys are fun. And just to carry that fun to the stage and have a damn good time every time you get on that stage, no matter what happens. They don't turn you off. They unplug you. They do whatever. Just keep playing. it works.
Will do.
It works. Well,
yeah.
Thank you all very, very much. And I would like to say it's 2 pints in a corner, closing out.